We good? All right. The March 16th?
Yes.
March 16th, 2017. Last time we said it was February. That wasn't right. March 16th, 2017, House Committee on Veterans Affairs and Emergency Management is now in session. As it is custom on Thursdays, we try to focus our attention on why we're here. Sometimes in the hustle and bustle of this building, we forget. So every Thursday, we try to have a little bit of a focus time. So that's what we're going to do first, then we'll get to the first public hearing. On Tuesday night, March 14, 2017, near Canada Air Force Base, New Mexico, 33-year-old pilot Captain Andrew Becker from Novi, Michigan, 29-year-old Captain Kenneth Dalga from Goldsboro, North Carolina, and 26-year-old co-pilot First Lieutenant Frederick Delacour from Daytona Beach, Florida, were killed in a training accident. All three were assigned to the 318 Special Operations Squadron of the 27 Special Operations Wing based at Canada Air Force Base. They flew a single-engine U-28 Alpha plane and were performing touch-and-goes, practice maneuvers in which an aircraft will touch the runway and take off again, probably in prep for going overseas. The 318 Squadron was activated under Air Force Special Operations Command in 2008 to provide battlefield mobility for our Special Operations Forces. As with last week's reading, in which a Marine back in January was killed in a live fire exercise 29 Palms, California, we as a nation must be always mindful and appreciative that an unfortunate consequence of military readiness is that sometimes military personnel are injured or killed in training accidents. This applies to all the branches of service. Our job here is to try to do the best we can with what resources we have to help military families and try to make the state ready so that fewer people will die when there's catastrophe. That's our focus. So, all right, we will now open public hearing on House Bill 2908. Representative Palouse, if you'd like to come up, we will actually have Mr. Volk read all the paperwork.
Thank you, Representative Evans. House Bill 2908. It creates the Veteran Volunteer Coordinator position within the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, specifies responsibilities, and requires ODVA to report to the legislature no later than September 15th of 2020. It appropriates general fund dollars, declares an emergency. Outreach is one of the core functions of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Oregon veterans are a diverse population spanning four generations from the five major wars. About 50% of Oregon's 300,000 veterans are age 65 or older, and only about 30% presently access or available benefits. House Bill 2908 creates the position of Veteran Volunteer Coordinator at ODVA. We have received the fiscals and revenues. There is a fairly complex fiscal statement here and a revenue statement, but we have received them. They are online for review.
Thank you.
Representative, thank you for coming, and thank you for presenting the bill. Go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Evans, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Carla Peluso, state representative from House District 50, the great city of Gresham. Now, before I focus on my bill request, I just want to say it's great to be back here in the Veterans Committee that I served on last session, even if it's just for a few minutes. And regardless of my committee current committee assignments, I will always support the work of the Veterans Committee and our veterans. Thank you all for what you do in this committee for our, not just our veterans, but our community. One of my proudest moments as a legislator was with your support and the support of the ODVA when we passed the Women's Vet Coordinator Bill. Our Women's Vet Coordinator, Elizabeth Estabrook, has been highly successful, and on behalf of our women vets, I also would like to say thank you. That being said, I am back for more. So, I am here today to ask for your support of House Bill 2908 to establish a volunteer coordinator position in the Department of Veterans Affairs. A sea of goodwill for veterans exists in our communities across the state, including the goodwill of many individuals who are enthusiastic about volunteering their time and service for vets, especially if their volunteer efforts include connecting with the veterans on a personal level. One of the greatest challenges for the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs is outreach. Connecting with vets, providing them with important and accurate information, and guiding them to people and organizations that provide benefits, aid, and assistance. For many veterans, the personal connection is very important. But volunteers could be a key resource for ODVA's outreach and connections to veterans. House Bill 28 establishes the position of Veterans Volunteer Coordinator within the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. This person will launch a program to recruit, train, and deploy a network of volunteers to reach veterans out in their communities. The strength of the program is based on leveraging the time, energy, and expertise of an army of volunteers. The veterans would be a major referral source for our county veterans service officers and would help veterans connect with these experts who can file their claims. The volunteers could be armed with information about local services and activities for veterans, particularly our aging veterans. Initially, the program would focus the volunteers on connecting aging veterans with local skilled nursing and assisted living facilities and organizations that primarily serve seniors, including Meals on Wheels and senior centers. The volunteers could serve as the local connection for ODVA's conservatorship and representative payee clients. I thank you for your attention. I thank you for what you do, and I hope you would support House Bill 2908.
Thank you, Representative. And always welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
Room on the sides if you want to join in.
Okay, then.
Any questions for the representative?
No.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for coming. Good luck with the rest of your schedule.
Thank you.
All right. We have a list of witnesses. I call Ms. Mary Yeager and Mr. Cameron Smith forward, please.
So good afternoon, Chair Evans and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And I will quickly turn over to Ms. Mary Yeager here. But when we were recruiting her from the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, a little bit smaller agency compared to ODVA, as a proud Marine, I embellished the amount of resources that we had at our significant agency to better serve veterans and their families. And we said there's more support and resources than you can imagine. Now that she's been on our team for a little bit, she will say that most of those resources are imagined. So this is a natural extension to better tap into that sea of goodwill that exists for our veterans, even as we have the fortunate opportunity this session and budget to increase the number of folks, whether advocates at the county or state level, on government roles. There is a sea of goodwill of citizens ready to stand up and better serve veterans. We're proud of our programs, but as we know, the needs and opportunities to better serve veterans are significant and large. And Mary's expertise that has grown out of Long-Term Care Ombudsman with volunteers, Oregonians serving Oregonians, neighbors helping neighbors, going into skilled nursing facilities, and feeding back where appropriate into government channels. The CASA model on foster care and the court, similar volunteer Oregonians linking hand in hand with those public missions of entities. And I would just note that this also, we thank Representative Peluso for bringing this forward, an excellent bill for your consideration, and grew out of 2015 Senate Bill 89, I believe, which gave broad authority to both the counties and states to appoint veteran volunteers at each of our levels, but recognizing that veterans, while highly leveraged, are not free, and this helps create the infrastructure to make it a real program going forward. I will hand over to Mary.
Thank you, Director Smith.
Thank you, Director Smith. For the record, I'm Mary Yeager. I'm the Aging Veteran Service Director for the Department of Veteran Affairs. So I've been in this position now for 2 years, two wonderful years. Cameron's a great boss and mentor, and everyone who works, I am not kidding you, at Oregon Department of Veteran Affairs really is a true advocate for our Oregon veterans. And while my work is really centered on those over 65, so literally over half of the veterans in Oregon fall into that aging category, one piece that is missing in the opportunity to support them is a core of volunteers. And as many of you know, State of Oregon is not new to having volunteers that are literally embedded in state agencies. Director Smith mentioned the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program. Small group of paid staff, but 290 volunteers across Oregon. Similarly, the CASA program, while county-based, again, a small number of FTEs working with anywhere from 15 to 40 volunteers a person. So while this is a tight budget year in this building, this opportunity to support Oregonians who would like to serve other veterans or Oregonians who are civilians who would like to serve veterans seems like a perfect opportunity to do it. So I won't go into any more detail. Rep. Peluso and Cameron kind of covered the topic. I'm glad to answer questions, but more than anything, we just thank you for your support.
Any questions for the presenters? Given the number of signers up here on the bill, probably not many questions today, but it's a great step forward, and appreciate your comments. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no other names, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2908. Members, I'm going to be asking that we hold this bill for a work session until we have a package to send down to Ways and Means, so they have it, get them all at one time, pretty much be able to move forward. But it is my intention to work this bill sooner than later. So. All right, we will now move to a public hearing to explain some things, then move into work session on House Bill 2100 with the -1 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Evans. The last time we heard this bill was on February 16th, and at that point we had a work session held together, created a -1 amendment, and there's two basic changes in the House Bill 2100. It first, the route is changed from Interstate 5 and continuing to Interstate 205 up into Washington State to a completely different direction. It goes on U.S. Highway 20 going east instead of north-south. Secondly, the name of the conflict to which the Medal of Honor recipient is associated is changed to the year the person received the Medal of Honor. And then finally, due to changes in the route and the conflict, several whereas clauses were changed. And we have received the revenue and fiscal statements, and as with last time, they're exactly the same. There was no revenue impact, and the fiscal people said there is a minimal expenditure impact.
Representative Lightly, would you like to explain perhaps the history of White House Highway 20 and some other things? Or
Sure. So originally, as proposed, Interstate 5 and Interstate 205, and I think we know Interstate 5 is already designated one of the memorial highways, and so that was one of the reasons not, I mean, attention. And also from a standpoint, especially 205, and being have any access to visibility to put a sign or the designation along it, given the traffic and that. And so all parties readily agreed that Highway 20 makes a better sense. And it turns out that several other states, Highway 20 is designated the same. And so if you look across the country, eventually we may have a route from west to east that's all the Medal of Honor recipients that are honored. So from that standpoint, it makes great sense. A couple of other changes, and so there was concerns. The original proposal listed the campaign, and there was concerns about the campaign being on the memorial signs, given how people view what some of those campaigns were in this day and age versus this when they occurred, and we thought that would be the more appropriate, and just to put that. So the other major change, though, is the location of the memorial signs. So rather than the memorial signs being located along the highway, they'll be located in rest areas and other pullouts along the highway where people could pull off on that. And doing so, it allows first, so those memorials, what we've agreed to, the memorials will include the award, a picture of the award, the person, the year in which the award was offered, and also they'll have a QR code. And so what people can do when they pull off and read a little bit about that, they can use that code with their smartphone, and they can go read all about that particular recipient. So get all the information about when they served, what the conflict was, why they were awarded the thing. So it provides a much better opportunity than it would have if a person was flying by on the road, not even realizing exactly what it was. So we think in the long term, it'll do a better job of honoring those recipients.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, sir. Representative Post.
Mr. Chair, I just want to add, it was great working with Representative Lively on this, and the idea of the year thing, for two reasons. For me, it's probably the only little thing that I contributed was the idea behind the year was not just to avoid some potential landmines with names, but I thought it was just cool that if you were a school bus full of school kids and you get to stop at this rest area or whatever it is and you see, making up a name, Bob Jones, Congressional Medal of Honor winner, 1937 or whatever year it was, now that's going to cause me to be able to tell a story to those kids about the whole thing. I just thought the year thing was a kind of a neat idea. But the fact that we're not whizzing by like we would have, and the QR code, I've never done one. I've seen them done, and I understand them, but
they're actually a World War II memorial out here, too.
I know.
Yeah. I've never done one either.
Yeah. I just think that there was a great job done on getting this where it is.
Thank you both for leading that up and Representative Lively especially.
Thank you to Paul and Leah for helping.
Thank you for ODOT and everybody involved. Any other questions on the amendment? Okay, seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing. We're going to open a work session to be able to consider the Dash 1 amendments. I don't think it takes a formal motion for amendments. I think we can simply say, is there anybody opposed?
You have to move to adopt.
Okay, then go ahead.
You want to roll forward.
Get this out of here.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt HB 2100 Dash 1 amendments dated 13 March 2017.
Okay, Representative Esquivel has moved to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated March 13, 2017. Any discussion on this? Okay, seeing no discussion, let's call the roll and get this roll.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. So the amendment is adopted. Now I'd like to call the question on the bill as amended. Is there a motion?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2100 as amended be moved to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel has moved that House Bill 2100 as amended be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of this? Seeing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Excused.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair Evans.
Aye. Motion passes. What I'd like to do is assign it to Representative Huffman.
Yeah, I think that would be appropriate.
Okay. Representative Huffman has it on the floor. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's assigned. All right. Rolling right along. We're going to now... Good.
Just for everyone's knowledge, if you ever get back to South Carolina on the Yorktown, they have a computer display and a large display of pictures and everything on every Congressional Medal of Honor recipient in the United States history.
Really?
It's really cool.
Okay. I'm going to hand you the gavel.
You going out front?
I am. Okay. But hopefully very briefly.
That's good. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2847. Will you read the bill, please?
Thank you, Vice Chair Esquivel. House Bill 2847 directs the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to develop a program to provide loan guarantees to refinance eligible veteran homes pursuant to contracts with financial institutions selected through a competitive process that specifies the content of the contracts, requires rulemaking to include fixed interest rates for the first 5 years of the contract, and to prohibit interest rates more than 3% above the prime lending rate. The bill establishes the Veterans Refinancing and Reintegration Service Fund to receive monies as specified for continuous appropriation to the ODVA exclusively for the program use. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs administers the ORVET home loan program for eligible veterans that is separate and in addition to the federal VA home loan guarantee benefits program. Oregon citizens voted to establish the program after World War II, and it is one of only six states to offer such a program. ODVA has successfully administered the ORVET home loan program for 75 years. It owns and services all of its loans and is required to make every effort to keep veterans in their homes. ODVA funds the program by selling tax-exempt bonds, and loan repayments are in turn used to pay off the bonds. ODVA may not use proceeds from the sale of tax-exempt bonds to refinance loans and does not currently offer refinancing. House Bill 2847 directs the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to develop a program to provide loan guarantees in order to offer refinancing to qualified veterans. I should say that in addition, we have received the fiscal and the revenue statements. I'll say again that the fiscal is a little bit complex. It's about a page long. And so it's again online for review.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Fancy seeing you out there.
I know. It's going to be one of those days. Vice Chair Esquivel, members of the committee, thank you again for your indulgence to present a bill that the last several years has been in consideration and often left on the chopping block because of money. This bill is really a unique bill because it attempts to approach part of the housing problem in a distinct way. One of the best ways to improve the homeless rates among Oregonians is to not let veterans get to the homeless category, to keep them in their homes. It sounds simple, but sometimes we overlook it. The situation right now is that for many veterans, and not that long ago I found myself in a similar situation, I know many have, the ORVET program does a great job on the mortgage, the first mortgage. But if you find yourself in a situation where refinancing is needed for any number of circumstances, the things that stand in the way of getting a refinance, missed payments or changes in economics or any number of things that can cause hiccups, really snowball and prevent folks from being able to access that tool. The ORVET program as a mortgage program is generally pretty close to or under the market value. That's the advantage of that program, to help people get into their homes. This program is not designed, by the way, to be the cheapest refinancing option. In fact, it probably won't be. But what this tool will be able to do is, for the folks that can't qualify in other situations, that can't qualify for more traditional refinance options, this would provide ODVA and a partner entity who has the ability to use money for this purpose, perhaps credit unions. Banks can apply, but quite frankly, it's more aligned with credit unions. Because the one thing that ODVA does and has a reputation for better than everybody else is they hold on to the note and they work with the person who has the house. So in a refinancing situation, especially with multiple deployments, which we're seeing now as not uncommon, it's envisioned that this program would allow ODVA a secondary tool, and between the partnership would hold on to the note so the house isn't basically sold out from underneath the veteran if they're having hard times, that they can work with the vet and stabilize that housing. Now, if it can be competitive in terms of pricing, great. But that's really not the biggest deal here. The biggest deal here is providing an option for folks who can't get refinancing assistance in any other circumstances and are willing to work to try to keep their home. This program is designed to provide a less direct profit for our partner, but a certain profit over time. We can leverage ODVA's assets to make sure that there is a certainty and a surety of return on investments. But it really does, I think, provide the state of Oregon and the veterans in Oregon with something that there is not another path to. Despite the television ads that you see on TV, all those folks offering refinance for veterans that are fighting hard times, the fine print is a little bit of a problem. So this program, I believe, provides the necessary authority to set up a partnership that makes refinancing, when necessary, available for veterans. It plays to the strengths of a credit union approach, where it's helping members and holding on to the note. It plays to the strengths of ODVA in terms of working with the veterans. And I think it's one of those things that, as we move forward with putting a comprehensive package for veterans on housing, on health care, on other entities, that this is one bookend of the story of housing. Any questions?
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir.
Next, we'll call up Cameron Smith and Cody Cox.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Esquivel, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And in light of the technical expertise on home loans, all things mortgage, refinance, mortgage insurance, have brought our big brain, Cody Cox, manager of our Veterans Home Loan Program, to give an overview of both what's available in refi markets, as is, some of the federal VA home loan options, and then a little overview of our program as well. So kick it over to Cody.
Thank you, Director Smith, Chair Evans, members of the committee. I'm Cody Cox. I am the Home Loan Program Director for ODVA, or as I like to say, I'm the face of the ORVET Home Loan Program. I've been with the agency for just a little over 3 years now, and one of the things I'd like to basically talk about, by being members of this committee, you obviously have a background of what the ODVA and the ORVET program is. For myself, and I think one of the reasons that I brought to this table is I've got 34 and a half years of experience in the mortgage industry. I have done basically just about every job there has been in the mortgage industry, from basically underwriting, from selling wholesale money, from being a loan originator, and also, you know, vice president with some national mortgage companies. So I think I bring to the table a little bit of some expertise when it comes to anything mortgage for the ODVA program. And so what I'd like to basically touch on here real briefly is kind of three things that I see in going through this bill. And the first thing is intent. And of course, as Representative Evans talked about, we've been trying to find a way to refinance or provide some sort of refinance program for our Oregon veterans for quite a while, and up until this point to no avail. But as I read this particular bill, it doesn't exactly provide the refinance product that we have been looking for in the past. It actually delegates this out to, as we've talked about, an outside agency that actually is going to provide the refinance monies. Our goal on this, or our contribution on this, would either be to provide a guarantee in the event of default on that mortgage, or some sort of insurance that, again, would provide an insurance coverage on the success of that particular mortgage. And so for our purposes, we become a mortgage insurance company is what it looks like, or we mirror what's already available through the federal VA program. And so there's a it doesn't quite, in my opinion, provide to us what we were looking for, what we may be looking for in the purpose of a refinance. It provides the insurance portion of it. So we become a mortgage insurance company. And again, part of the reason for a high fiscal on this is that the insurance regulations say that as a mortgage insurance company, we have to have a minimum fund and keep it at that level or higher of $4 million at all times. So that's a chunk of change to get this program up and running. Now, the second thing I'd want to look at is who is our target market on this? And I, again, as Representative Evans talked about, there is a certain segment of the veteran population that may not be served by the regular home loan programs available either through the federal VA refinance program or any of the other FHA or conventional home loan programs. But what this program does is not only does it turn us into a insurance company, it turns us into a subprime mortgage insurance company, because the folks that cannot get a home loan are the ones we would become Plan B. And so what that brings us to the table is, in our current servicing portfolio at ORVET, our delinquency numbers are less than half of what you see in Oregon, or less than half of what you see on a national basis. This particular program has the potential to slide us over to service folks who have, you know, bruised credit and cannot get a loan anywhere else. In my experience, a veteran should be able to get a loan in most situations, not all, but in most situations, unless they have some, again, bruised credit, or they'd have the income that would, you know, service the debt. And so those kind of knock those particular customers to oftentimes no fault of their own down into a different level as far as servicing that loan and then loan quality. And so we've enjoyed a high level of loan quality at Orbit for such a long time. So this is going to be, you know, way outside of our norm. Part of the bill talks about prudent investment and lending practices. So setting up a standard that would minimize our losses and still kind of serve that community is going to be, you know, a big heavy lift. And I guess I would say that anywhere in the bill that says ODVA shall can also read Cody Cox shall, because that's going to be something that's going to bounce onto my desk. So we have to ask, and a couple other things just to think about. If we have a financial institution, which the way I read the bill, that's singular, that we've picked one financial institution to provide this type of financing, they are actually lending the money. We are not lending the money. And so, therefore, we will not hold that note. The company will hold the note in a mortgage, and we just provide that insurance in the event of default. And so there's a little difference there that we have a loss of control during the course of servicing on that particular loan. We don't have the ability to employ our normal high-quality loss mitigation processes because we don't own the note. We are simply the guarantor or the insurer on that note. And so the other thing, and I think I've touched on this a little bit, that I would say has to do with risk. Because one of the things in the mortgage industry nowadays, we're all looking at risk. When the Dodd-Frank legislation came into play, we had a lot of things that talked about qualifying mortgages, ability to repay. And so most of our partner financial institutions that we're currently receive funds or loans in from a third-party origination basis have that ability to repay in the qualifying mortgage in their sites. They have to comply with the Dodd-Frank legislation under that auspices. So whether or not that risk is something they're going to take a look at as well, because it's going to be on their books, not so much on our books. And the other thing is that I say with the federal VA loan program, is they're able to mitigate that risk by having a whole bunch of different institutions that actually are lending on their behalf and holding that note. And second of all, they're able to diversify it over the entire country to try and reduce the risk. So we narrow our risk focus by using one financial institution in just a geographic area of Oregon. And so that brings some concerns to me as well. So with that kind of, you know, the thing going through the insurance company hoops to make sure that we meet the requirements is going to require certain licensure. So we have to have the licenses, you know, and all the other things that go along with setting up a private mortgage insurance company in the state of Oregon. So, you know, for all intents and purposes, I think that the intent is very noble, trying to find the opportunity to provide some refinances through ODVA. I'm not quite sure we're there with this particular bill quite yet.
Questions? I know I have two.
My question is probably more of you now after he spoke than it is of him. But so I'm still trying to understand the target. So somebody needs to describe for me an example of who this person, what the condition might be that the person seeking refinancing.
Sergeant John Maxwell, coming back from his second tour. He's a National Guard guy, trying to get a job when he comes back, still has some income, but not what he used to, trying to keep hold of his house while he was gone, finance wasn't so great. He goes into and says, look, I now have this job, but I don't have great credit. My finances are such that I need to be able to minimize some of my expenses. I need help.
So we're not talking about somebody that had an ODVA. We're talking about a veteran that hasn't had this loan in some other way to refinance.
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
Yes.
I didn't get that started.
Could have
Thank
a conventional.
You.
Could have a...
Could have, right.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that it's not what you want. How fast or how slow can you get me the amendments you need to make it work?
To make Representative Evans, this, to make
get
this
you the
particular
tool,
program work?
To get you the tool you said you wanted.
Chair Evans, the refinance program is inhibited by IRS regulations.
You started your comments saying you wanted to have a refinance tool. So what is it?
Chair Evans, I would like the opportunity, yes, the ability, of course, to have a refinance program to offer to our programs. Trying to overcome those hurdles is what's been difficult in the past. So do I have an ideal program to relay to you guys at this particular moment? No, I don't, because until we see some light at the end of the tunnel of overcoming these particular IRS hurdles, it wouldn't make a lot of sense for us to go through the motions to try and do that until we see some sort of resolve on the IRS level.
And Chair Evers, members of the committee, so this grows out of there's kind of multiple possible solutions on a refi for our own program specifically. Qualified veteran mortgage bonds that are those tax-advantaged IRS federal tax-advantaged bonds, they have that cap on 25 years of service and no refiability. Nothing preventing us from today offering refinance, right, if we had the pot of ongoing funds, whether off of...
This was designed to provide the pot of money to be able to do that with.
Correct. But we want to also be able to retain... So not the problem has been our... there's refi available today, but they are then leaving our books, going off, leaving our loan program. These would still be going from our loan program onto someone else's books for their principal and mortgage interests longer term.
The intent that legislative council was supposed to draft, which we can't have redrafted until they get right, was for ODVA to have the authority to enter into a partnership with more than one entity, but that entities would have an opportunity through RFP to compete, so we weren't favoring one particular entity. But that money could be leveraged in partnership with ODVA holding the note, but the profit going to the other entity.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, I think that was the one difference in your testimony, and for clarification, we can work with Ledge Council. Holding the note would be a different scenario where it still is staying on ODVA's books and not leaving, kind of stopping that refi drain that we've currently seen.
Okay.
And certainly, I mean, there's what I'd like to emphasize. There are hurdles to implementing. We can certainly implement it if the policy decision is, let's go and do it.
If this is drafted the wrong way, we'll redraft it to where it needs to be. The question is, can we find a way to meet the need?
Can we fix it?
Right.
I think so. And I think the one question in my mind still is, if it's still in that mortgage insurance mode, is there any exemption to the, or is there any flexibility on what we would have to hold in reserves, mm-hmm, like a normal mortgage insurance? Because that would be a significant chunk just from the get-go. I think it was a $4 million minimum, that mortgage insurers have to have on hand and not drop below so that there's never a gap.
Okay. Any other questions, Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your MIP, I don't know, would that go up according to your amount that you have guaranteed?
Chair Evans, I mean,
you're talking
members
$4 million,
of the
committee. But that, if it grows and grows and grows and you're you're behind, you're doing MIP on 100 ohms, then wouldn't that base, that nucleus of that money have to rise?
It would have to, because the $4 million is a minimum amount.
That's
yeah,
the floor level.
Yeah, that's the floor level. Yeah.
Yep. A little bit side question. It's not necessarily about this bill, but it's about home mortgage, since I have you up here. Do we ever fix the piece where if you use the program and then you had the $470,000, you used it, maybe your loan was for $220,000, you sell that house, that you could come back and take the full 417 again? Because it used to be you could only then take the other $200,000, which doesn't necessarily buy you a house these days anymore.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, finally an easy question. Yes, we have fixed that. Basically, an Oregon veteran has the ability to use the ORVET eligibility four times during the course of their lifetime. Mm-hmm. Only one at a time, of course, but sure, four times. And
it reset.
Yeah, and the maximum loan level increased to 424.1.
Yeah.
It's no longer 417.
Representative?
Oh, he answered my question there.
Representative Lewis, you look like you have a question.
Yeah.
Representative Post. Really? All right. We have until April 7th. To move things. So if there are amendments and you want this capability,
you have until April 18th, April 7th to schedule
Right.
They have until April 7th to know if it's worthy to schedule. You have until April 7th if you want this capability.
Okay.
Public hearing is closed.
Work it.
Before you drop the hammer on that. Before you got here, Cameron, before you arrived, we had talked in this committee. I think I'm the only one that was here in that time. We talked about mirroring, doing a mirror on federal VA standards. And we're going to work with ODVA to mirror those standards 100% and, you know, to do a finance, but not necessarily to do away with some of the incoming cost of the startup costs. But did we run into a blank wall on that? Because I haven't heard anything for about 6 years on that.
Chair Evans, Vice Chair Esquivel. So that strength of the VA, and I'll turn over again quickly to Cody, but the strength of the VA home loan program at the federal level is that zero down component, often for returning veterans and their families, not to have that out-of-pocket down payment and then begin to be able to make those payments. And that comes, again, from that loan guarantee spread across the entire nation from the Fed VA. Whereas the strength of the home loan program for ODVA for the 70-plus years was that the tax advantage bonds with a lower interest rate. But often for a young gun coming home...
5% down.
Right. And then they would often still have, if not, you know, some, you know, if not the full 20% down, it's certainly a good chunk down to qualify for our ODVA or VET home loan program. To be able to get the breadth, and then similarly... we have a lot of interest from older Vietnam veterans, still have some flexible funds. They have some capital to put down and can take advantage of that below market interest rate. So in looking to try to mirror that federal VA zero down component, playing with some flexibility on the loan to value ratios for ORVETs, as long and along with some down payment assistance that we were able to try to get off of the recording fee dollars through the Oregon Housing and Community Services. But some of the requirements that came along with that down payment assistance have essentially not met. Those that are coming forward with that need for down payment then get washed out of eligibility for that down payment assistance due to some of the rules that have come along with those funds on some of the low income. And I'll kick it, see if I got it somewhat correct.
Yeah, you got it correct. Chair Evans, members of the committee, the down payment assistance program that Director Smith referred to basically had some hurdles to try and make to allow customers and borrowers to qualify. One of those had to be with income limitations. Basically, it targeted 80% of median income in the respective counties. And as we saw, and you guys have all saw, you know, housing prices escalate at pretty rapid levels, it very quickly priced them out of even qualifying for a loan in those amounts. So even though the loan amount today is up to 424.1, there's not a lot of people that had income up to 80% of the median income for the respective county could qualify for that. When in the Tri-County area, you know, the median sales price of a house exceeds $400,000. The other hurdle with that particular down payment assistance program had to do with the cost of the private mortgage insurance. If you're going to do a 3% or 5% down, and even if you had very, very good credit scores to qualify for the lesser amount tiers for the private mortgage insurance, when you did a cost-by-cost comparison, the payment to the veteran borrower on a ODVA 97% with DPA, a part of it was higher than what a 100% VA loan would be. So you have the loan originators out in the field who are required to do cost comparisons and look at different loan programs. It invariably went to a federal VA program on that. But one of the things that we don't really entertain very often is that our program allows for the max loan to value to be at the same levels where the federal VA program is at, which is typically 103% of the sales price. Now, on a conventional loan, we wouldn't lend 103%. We would lend 97.95. But there are provisions for seller carrybacks, maybe some sort of other assistance that come from grants or other down payment type things. So, or even mom and dad, if their automated underwriting submission allows for the stronger borrower, mom and dad can gift them that 5% and cover all their closing costs. So there are some creative ways ways to try and structure essentially a program for that under the ODVA where that borrower, veteran borrower, does not have any out-of-pocket money. But again, those are all on purchase transactions, and so, you know, obviously our discussion here is focused on the refinance.
Representative?
So we are you telling us that we may be pricing people out of the market as these accelerate in value in the Portland area?
Yeah, Chair Evans, members of the committee, I would say that we are possibly losing some market share just simply because of house prices. I would say that's a fair statement. In fact, I would also go on to say that if you look at our loan volume, I would say a portion of the loan volume that decreased to some degree in 2016 over 2015 was related to just how many homes are available in the market, you know, just the what's available, as well as the prices continue to go up. So, yeah, there are very much concerns that point right to just housing prices that may not be available to, you know, our veterans.
Go ahead.
Director Smith, do me a favor and don't say older Vietnam veteran, please.
Chair, members of the committee are more experienced and wiser members of our veterans.
Just veterans.
Closing the public hearing.
Wait. since you're twisting my arm, I just thought I would point out, Mr. Chair, that we have representatives from the credit union here.
Yes.
Credit union. I'm sure they would love to get in on this act somehow. Not testify, but just, you know, so anybody would, I'm sure, could go to them and ask some really good questions.
Representative Post, in fact, their representative is sending supporting letter for this concept. Was supportive in the concept draft over the last 2 years, and actually one OSU, I think, credit union out there, we talked earlier about how they are an interested partner in this project.
Good.
So if we get the right amendments,
to be my branch manager, I'm a little picky.
So credit unions, I think, are a natural fit because of the way in which they focus on the customer base within their membership. But good point. Thank you. If you have questions, they're good people, and they are big brain people that are smart. Yep. We're going to close the public hearing. All right. We will revisit this April 7th. We're now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2887. And unusually, I'm not going to go down and try to explain this. I'm going to explain it from here because this is a committee bill, and it has to go to revenue. This bill is designed, it is the device that will hopefully create a tax credit for employers hiring veterans. And Mr. Volk is going to explain it.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. House Bill 2887 creates a personal and corporate income tax credit for employers who hire qualifying military veterans, permits employers with 100 or less employees a tax credit of $1,000 per qualifying veteran per year, increasing $100 per year, not to exceed $1,500. Permits all other employers $750 per qualifying veteran per year, increasing $100 per year, not to exceed $1,250. Authorizes rulemaking by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. Applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2017, and before January 1st, 2023, takes effect on the 91st day after sendee. The Work Opportunity Tax Credit is a federal tax credit available to private businesses and certain nonprofit organizations for hiring certain individuals, including veterans, who may face barriers to employment. The WOTC only applies to new employees and is a one-time credit for per employer for hiring persons from targeted populations. There is currently no tax credit exclusively for hiring veterans. House Bill 2887 creates a personal and corporate credit against income taxes for hiring qualified veterans. We have received the fiscal and revenue statements. To boil it down into very simple terms, they've called it revenue light and minimal fiscal impact.
And before we invite up the panel, the
revenue light, really?
The point of this particular bill the point of this credit a little bit different than many, in that it sets targets for small companies and larger companies, and the second and third year, it increases the tax credit, because what has happened, at least what has been anecdotally noticed across the country, is that in some instances, a veteran is hired, that tax credit is given, and then the next year, that veteran isn't there anymore. So that companies sometimes have an incentive to keep hiring and not necessarily holding on. This is designed to create an environment where there's an incentive to hold on for a couple of years at least, where either A, the employee is starting to be a major contributing factor, or B, if they're not, at least they have something on their resume that's not a one-year-and-done kind of deal. It may be very flexible. It may be having to be adjusted when it gets to revenue, but it is the start of the conversation. And I'd like to invite up the three folks that have signed up, Jana Jarvis, Jared Smith, and Lauren Holm, please. When you approach the microphone, please say who you are and where you're from and what you want to say, please. And welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jana Jarvis, president of the Oregon Trucking Associations. We just talked about helping veterans get homes. Now we want to talk about helping veterans get jobs. And interestingly enough, that's a theme that the trucking industry, by and large, has been talking about for some time. And I thought I would just give you briefly a little background about that, talk to you about what we're starting to work on here in Oregon, and then introduce you to Jared Smith, who's the Director of Human Resources, and Lauren Holm, who's the lead recruiter for Redaway, right in Tualatin.
So. Great.
With that, I'll let you know that the American Trucking Association has been on this topic now since 2012. They've testified before Congress to expand the educational benefits for vets. They testified to Congress and got the Military Commercial Driver's License Act passed, and that act allowed veterans who got out of the service before they reached 21. You know, you have to be 21 to drive interstate, and most insurance companies require you to be 23 or even 25. And so there's this real gap for young people before they are interested or able to even get into the industry. So this particular act would take time served and experience served and allow them to go ahead and get a CDL. So we worked on that as well. ATA has what they call a Hiring Our Heroes initiative with a goal of hiring 100,000 vets nationally. And they are working and continue to develop educational programs to help companies better know how to reach out and recruit vets. And with that in mind, and I've been president of this association just a couple of years, I've been watching some of this and thinking there's great opportunities for us here in Oregon as well. And what can we as an association do to get involved with that? And so with that, I thought I would introduce you to Redaway, because while I was talking about it, their CEO said, well, we have a program and there's great opportunities to grow it. And so with that, I'll turn the mic over.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Evan, members of the committee. My name is Jared Smith. I'm the Director of Human Resources at Redaway. Our corporate headquarters is in Tualatin. We have more than 3,000 employees spread throughout the western United States, with more than 500 in the state of Oregon. We have terminals in Portland, Medford, Eugene, Roseburg, and among our employees, we have more than 200 veterans, with approximately 20% within this state.
Thank you for doing that.
It's been our privilege. In 2016 alone, we completed our target for the Hiring Our Heroes program. Since 2014, we've hired more than 150 veterans. We became a partner in the Army Pays program, and we were recognized as a military-friendly employer. The careers in this industry represent financial freedom for many. Our P&D drivers will typically make more than $60,000, approximately $62,000 in a year. Our line haul drivers in Oregon made approximately $69,000 on average this year, with many of our more senior drivers doing more than $10,000 more than that. That's in addition to company-paid fully company-paid health insurance premiums, a 401k that does not require matching, invests immediately at 100%, and several other benefits I could go on.
How good a driver do you have to be to drive? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Pretty good, which speaks to my next point. The CDO Act was mentioned, which has been a great benefit to our veterans. But one of the things we see is there is a large transition between driving in a military environment and pulling a set of doubles between Boise and Portland, or as well as driving through a city. What Redaway has done, a couple things. One, we have an extended training program specifically targeted for veterans, and in a driving training program, that's not a class of 20 people. That's you and a experienced driver who meets significant qualifications in the truck together, typically for more than a week extra, making your runs, making your entire shift side by side. In some cases, maybe 2 to 3 weeks extra time. And that's just for drivers. We have similar for mechanics, for management, other positions. Redaway has a fairly good track record of promotion for veterans. Two of our four division vice presidents are veterans. We've had veterans become safety managers, excel in management, and hit big, large milestones for us, such as million miles safe driving. So all things that show it's a commitment that pays off for us. What we see is there's significant, to make sure people are successful and safe, there is a significant upfront cost to ensure the training is proper to make sure that the people we put on the road or in any position are in a position to succeed. Which is why we think this bill, it wouldn't cover the cost. Well, the tax credits wouldn't cover all the difference in cost training a veteran versus someone in the industry. It would provide relief, and we can see a path where it would help us create extra trainers and extra ability to train a greater number of veterans at one time. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chair Evans, members of the committee, thank you for your time. My name is Warren Holm. I'm the lead recruiter with Redaway. I've been with Redaway since August. My background, 20 years in the Army. I retired in 2007. Since 2007, I've worked multiple different jobs in different companies. I joined right away. I was hired. I'm not sure if they felt sorry for me, but I will say this. Being a vet and part of this organization shares the same passion that I do when it comes to recruiting and hiring vets is special. I have been able to develop a great network with the vet reps, veteran representatives at the Oregon Employment Department and other organizations within the state of Oregon. I would like to be in a position where I can hire more vets, and that's my passion, and I'll continue. I will say with Redaway, the environment when it comes to being vet-friendly is unsurmountable. Truly appreciate it. And Redaway has put a lot of time in training me because I'm new to the trucking industry, invested a lot in my training, and I think this bill would definitely put us in a position to be able to hire more vets. Thank you for your time.
Questions? I have a couple questions. So in the Army, what was your MOS? What'd you do?
Chairman Evans, my first job in the Army was supply. I did that for 14 years, and then I got the letter in the mail from the Department of Army saying, Sergeant Holm, good job, go be a recruiter, and you can't say no. So I grew up in Roseburg. I'm an Oregonian. I was really fortunate to end up back here in Oregon. I was a recruiter in Albany for a couple years. It worked out really well. My towns were Corvallis, Philomath, Alsea. And then I was convinced by my boss, Station Commander, First Sergeant, to change my job to recruiting. And so once I did that, then I took over my own recruiting team in Beaverton. And then I bounced down for a year in Chico, retired, bounced back to the great state of Oregon. So I was supply and then a recruiter.
So the reason I was asking is I had a feeling there was a recruiting background there somewhere. So the question I have is, and again, dated information. I put the uniform away in 2013. So at the time, because of the number of deployments, one of the issues for folks, either active, reserve, guard, didn't matter, that had spent time overseas, multiple deployments, was finding employment in areas and with companies that had some of the sense of family, some of the sense of connection. And to the point that the Right Away is a trucking company, which most people would think you're always gone, you're always traveling, et cetera, it sounds like there's something else going on there as far as people feeling welcome. So I'd invite you into company as a whole. If you're comfortable with it, we'd like to learn maybe, obviously tax credits are not why companies would do it, but it might offset some of the costs. If there are specific things that you're seeing working in making that environment where vets want to go, we'd also like to see that side of the equation. So it's less of a question than a request for more information if you have it. Yeah.
Chair Evans, I'd like to comment on that. I neglected to mention to you that there's a great driver shortage nationally already. Right. We estimate there's about 45,000 drivers short and growing. There are some estimates that put it over a couple hundred thousand in the next few years. The average age of the driver is in the mid-50s. And so it's a very, and as I already mentioned to you, the difficulty to get young people right. fresh out of high school into this career. There's a few years in there where you miss out on that. And so sometimes driving is obviously a second career. And so promoting the industry in a variety of ways is something that the Oregon Trucking Association is going to work on. But connecting with our vets is a really kind of a pet project in that, because these folks many of them have experience driving heavy equipment or driving trucks. So they come to it with a knowledge base that's valuable and a work ethic that's admirable. So how we can connect these together, Right Away is not the only company that hires vets. I don't want to leave that impression, but they have a very good, solid program, and I thought it would be good for you to hear about it today.
I really appreciate all of you sharing. I really do. And to the extent that you'd be willing to share some of the internal pathways that you follow to be able to plus up the number of vets that you have, I'm pretty certain everybody up here would be very interested in that as well.
Chair Evans, absolutely. I can speak to some, and Lauren can speak to some as well. One of the things we find is most important is communicating with our management team so there can be understanding. I was privileged to have someone who was lots more intelligent and versed in this than me mentor me in some of the things, and there's so many little differences. A veteran is trained to speak about things in context of the team. In an interview context, our managers are typically trying to make sure we've siphoned out your individual contribution. And even just being aware of things like that and how awkward that can make someone feel in a high-pressure interview setting where they really want a job and maybe they haven't done 15 interviews in the last 3 years,
right,
is a big deal to making sure that people come in and don't feel put on the spot right away. Also, training our managers and particularly our recruiting team to be able to understand how different experiences may convey and speak to the people who are coming in on that level, I think helps make them feel welcome and make them feel like the door is open. Looking for a job is stressful. And anything that a company can do to help speak that language from the start, we find to be a great investment and worthwhile.
I'm going to indulge myself and ask one more question, sorry. When you're driving large equipment overseas in certain environments, it is polar opposite from what you generally find yourself in a city. And sometimes the things that are normal in a city freak you out, because if you see something like that somewhere else, it's not going to end well. Yeah. So is your peer-to-peer or side-by-side training, is that basically taking folks out to get them used to still big equipment but a fundamentally different driving environment, or are there other types of training techniques that you use? Because that seems to me, at least with a lot of the guys that I know coming back, that they still wouldn't like to go to drive to Portland on their own if they had to, much less doing it for a job. So how have you been able to go through that?
Chairman Evans, on several points. One, it is a lot of peer-to-peer. Okay. But two, there's also systems that can be integrated on that. One of the great benefits we find and why we think veterans tend to excel in when we measure safety is that step-by-step thought processing where you pay attention to the details, which, you know, to speak to your point, it is intimidating the first time someone looks in their rear view driving a double and sees that much space behind them. And driving through a city, I didn't like driving a Penske truck through a city. I mean, let alone something a lot longer than that. But we use system training to help bring it into people's terms, bring it into a step-by-step process so they can be safe and convey some of that knowledge. And as well, you know, one of the things that someone coming from a military environment might be more used to is, depending on where they're coming from, you know, they might be used to looking at more equipment than someone like me, who pretty much checks the speedometer and makes sure their tank's not empty. And trucks more and more becoming advanced pieces of machinery with lane departures, cameras going very well. I actually think that the veteran transition will increase if it's done well and systems convey, and we also spend the appropriate time in the one-on-one settings to make sure habits become ingrained. So I'm not sure if that's responsive, but I think there's a combined approach between the two that will help make people successful.
And the sergeant next to you is saying, we have a checklist, so it's all going to be okay.
Chair Evans, I'd also like to contribute to the conversation in that, yes, we are a trucking company, and we do have drivers, but we have multiple different other positions, such as mechanics.
Right.
We have dock workers, basically your warehouse, your supply people. We have clerks. And operation supervisors. Now, we find the veterans, military, National Guard, what have you, to be very effective in those particular positions. What works for us best is we have partnered with the vet reps, as I mentioned earlier. We partnered with ESGR, National Guard. I give presentations on a regular basis to National Guard, job fairs, things of that nature. So we're really active when it comes to hiring not just vets, but for National Guard. Because you mentioned a story earlier about an individual coming back from Iraq, if I recall. And we're in a position where we have a network of those individuals that can refer that person to us, and we can get them a job in any one of those positions.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to close the public hearing on this bill. I'd like to move it to revenue if we could.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question on the bill.
I have questions, too.
What's the question?
I don't see, and maybe I've missed it, but I don't see any sideboards on it in the aspect that there has to be a flooring for the hour-per-hour pay. Maybe we could put a ceiling on maybe 3 years.
Okay.
Because after 3 years, you're going to keep someone.
I'm going to open up the public hearing again on this House bill. So what I'm hearing is perhaps the need for a dash one.
And I've got a couple different questions. So.
Go ahead.
Okay, so line 29 on page 1, only one taxpayer may claim the credit allowed under this section for each qualified military veteran in any tax year. So that's a little bit going to be problematic for, I would imagine, the Department of Revenue. We might want to ask them about that. So I hire a veteran in my widget company. They come in as management. They work for me half the year, but they accumulate 1,500 hours. And then Mark hires them for the rest of that half of the year. We both met the 1,000-hour threshold. How do I know whose tax baby he is, right? Like, so that's a problem.
I don't know, but that person's going to be very busy if they're doing both those things.
Well, and if you think in a 52-hour work week, it's a 2,100 hours.
I'm saying good question.
And so who's the onus of having to understand who gets to claim him if we both meet the criteria in a tax year? So maybe that line either needs to be improved or just taken out, because I don't know that the Department of Revenue is going to track the actual individual person. So that's question number one. I appreciate that you can carry forward the credit, so that's our friends in revenue might not like that, but I like it. But the question I have, the bill is silent on whether or not I can retroactively amend my taxes to claim it. So I hire Sally Veteran in fiscal year 2016, I'm filing my taxes and I miss it or I don't. We had, and this comes up actually out of a different piece of legislation that we passed that does not allow people to go back and amend. So this is silent on that. So then I realized I did qualify under the law. I want to go back and amend my tax return. Does this bill let me do that? I don't see one way or the other whether it's...
I think that's a great question for an amendment.
So anyway.
I would think that we should contact the Department of Revenue because if it's silent, then they probably could. Through different rules through...
Which I would like, because the one that we did not do that on, we have not fixed it, and business owners are cranky with us.
Or we could write an amendment that explicitly says it.
That's right.
Well,
there we go.
Yeah.
Let's do that. I'm good. So those would be my two things.
You have two things? You had a question about a floor?
Well, I think that maybe I didn't see a floor on an hour per wage per hour, because I don't think we want to have people going in at minimum wage and getting a credit. And then the other thing is the ceiling of the number of years, maybe put a ceiling of 3 years that you can get the credit for a three-year period, because after 3 years, you're going to keep someone, especially if they're a good veteran.
Okay. Any other?
Does that sound reasonable?
Sounds reasonable to me.
I think Director Smith, the guy that calls us old guys.
Public hearing is still going?
Wants to talk.
I don't know about the wage floor. I don't mind the year floor. But this could be a really good opportunity for somebody to make the decision to hire. It might be a lower wage job, but maybe they're on the cusp of sort of like, I'm right about ready to grow my business and trying to figure out how to get that done. And it could be that this helps propel them to a new level of business to help do that. So I'm not necessarily hung up on wage, what the wage is. I don't mind saying you get this for 3 years, and then after that,
I just don't want to supplement minimum wage jobs.
Okay, so we're going to bring in Director Smith to this. Go ahead.
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of ODVA. Just on an overarching, you were Johnny on the spot with that close of the public hearing. Just generally, this is a smart approach, just like we've seen on preference for public employment. Many states have modeled tax credits to better employ veterans. For those that do, we know the values, the leadership, the skills and experience that our veterans bring. This gets folks into the mix, and they are going to prove that strength over and over. And this a smart approach, not just on the recruitment, but that retention that it increases over those 3 years is smart and could be a powerful package to better employ veterans across Oregon. And if either here or in revenue, if you're considering amendments, Department of Revenue, I bet, would appreciate the authority vice us writing the rules on how to implement.
We just naturally have. We give the authority to you write rules because we like to do that, but we can
amend
that.
Chair Evans, I just don't know. I don't think we would write rules for their ORS Chapter 315 tax code with any expertise.
But it could be fun. Okay, so, Mark, Representative Meek,
yes,
go ahead.
Ching, thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question to Mr. Smith, but related to, it says takes effect for January 1st, 2017. So I'm not sure why we'd want to go retroactively give somebody a credit for last year, especially if this year we want them to hire a veteran and keep this program going on for future years. I mean, I'd like to see it be effective now and hopefully have them continue on with the service of the veteran for years to come.
Okay. So I hear three different perspectives on about two different issues. So it's time for a work group. What we're going to do.
Task force time.
Gosh. You've been quiet.
Way to throw a third thing into the mixing.
My head.
Okay. So let's do this. We know the 7th is a date that's important. So if the three of you and or Representative Lewis, Representative Post, and whoever else would like to join in, but if the three of you could work together on sending a single amendment, so we don't confuse LC. Sometimes they get a little bit nervous with that. But I think capping it above minimum wage, but close to minimum wage, 3 years, and you know, however you want to work the retroactivity, whatever you guys agree on, sounds good. The only concern I have is making sure we come up to a consensus and getting it to revenue in time for Phil and the gang to work it. Okay?
The other thing, last question is, would also be, what is the requirement for proof of veteran status? I show up, I say I'm a veteran, I'm not a veteran. Do I give a DD-214 to an employer?
I think, I mean.
It says in here, qualified military veteran,
but
hired within 7 years, honorable discharge.
The goal was to basically, the things that people currently use for trying to get veterans preference would be the similar stuff, but I think that could be spelled
out. I don't think we have that like in the private sector so much as veterans preference. So somewhere there needs to be a proof of.
Copy of their DMV-14.
Mm-hmm. Chair Evans, members of the, I mean, very similar, whether you're getting a license plate from DMV, often within the rules mm-hmm. that would be written, they would specify which documents would be eligible.
But what are we going to tell employers yeah. that they need? And so that piece just needs to be.
Right.
If you're saying that's through the administrative rule process, that's fine. We just want to make sure employers know what they
employers.
Need to do from a paperwork perspective, because the bill's sort of silent on that.
So can the three of you get together on the amendment before next
sure.
week?
Yes.
So, again,
okay. Well, I'm leaving until next week. When do you want to?
But I mean,
next Thursday?
By next Thursday,
okay.
Can you guys get
yeah.
one amendment mm-hmm. draft to LC? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Any other further words, Director Smith? Sure. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go slow this time.
We should leave it to our old person who's
our
more senior.
Veteran.
Okay. The public hearing is closed
veteran.
Before it gets too weird here. And seeing no other business, we're going to be closing this edition of the Oregon House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Services.
That's a good bill.
Yes.
Good bill.
Yes.
That's a good bill.
Yes.
Good bill.
Yes.